Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's August 2021, and this is episode 249, which is a conversation about a New York Times opinion piece about miscarriages and abortion. On this episode, I'm joined by Jay Watts, who is founder and president of Merely Human Ministries, Inc., an organization committed to equipping Christians and people who hold pro-life views to graciously defend the intrinsic dignity of all human life in a positive and gospel-focused manner. Jay has written an online exclusive article for the Christian Research Journal called "Do Abortion Politics Hurt Women Enduring Miscarriage?" And you can access it if you're a subscriber on our website, equip.org. If you're not a subscriber, this is one of the benefits to access our online exclusive articles, and you can go to our website to subscribe to our journal. Jay, it's good to have you on.
It is great to be back.
Well, this episode is about Jay's article in response to a New York Times opinion piece back in June 2021, and the title of that opinion piece is called "Miscarriages Are Awful and Abortion Politics Makes Them Worse." It was a piece written by two women who are involved in reproductive rights. One, Amanda Allen, is an attorney in reproductive rights specifically, and the other one, Carrie Siestra, is someone who advocates for reproductive rights. And so at the beginning of their piece, they write this, quote, "Up to 26% of pregnancies end in miscarriage. These losses can be as physically painful as they are emotionally wrenching, and yet many patients are not afforded the best care for their miscarriages because of abortion politics." So according to this article by Allen and Siestra, like, how do they exactly say that abortion is hurting women who go through miscarriage?
Well, the treatment for miscarriage, when a woman goes in, and they share personal stories. And in both of their personal stories, they went in for a checkup around 7 or 8 weeks looking for a healthy heartbeat, and there was none. And so both of them were facing that horrible moment of miscarriage. At that point, the nascent human life inside them has ceased to flourish and has died. And so the next step of miscarriage is either the natural expulsion of that tissue that remains, or you do something to hasten it. There's multiple different ways that you can do that. Obviously, surgical options, which would mirror the same way that you do an abortion. But the other way would give people a dosage of misoprostol, which is the second pill that's usually given in an abortion protocol that causes women to push the child out, right? It causes the cramping, and it causes the endometrial wall to smooth and to push the remains of the child out. Now, the claim is, and what they're trying to gather data on medical research, is that actually giving mifepristone at the same time, ahead of it, just as you would in the abortion protocol, will make this process easier and more successful. But because of the nature of mifepristone, it's difficult to get. It falls into what's called a regulatory restriction with the Food and Drug Administration. And that regulatory restriction means only doctors who go through certain regulation hoops they're willing to jump through can prescribe it. And it has to be given by those doctors in their offices. And so it's harder to get. And because of that, they say the politics that surround abortion are now entering into the lives of women who are having miscarriages, because in their definition, the best possible care, which affords the woman the most privacy, would be to have a cycle of mifepristone with misoprostol and to go home and to do it in the privacy of their own home and to endure the ending of it. And they can't simply do that. These two women, were given other options. Those options were surgical or misoprostol by itself, or just managed care and waiting to see what happens.
So what's the difference? In other words, misoprostol, you know, for miscarriages, and then the other drug, both of them working together as it relates to abortion. I mean, how different is it? You know, why wouldn't it apply to both abortion and miscarriages? Is there a difference in terms of why they feel that both of these drugs should be available for miscarriages?
Well, for mifepristone, what it does is a progesterone inhibitor, right? So as it works in abortion, it blocks progesterone from being delivered. And so the woman's, uterus, the endometrial wall thins, and this disconnects the trophoblast from the uterine wall. So it basically disengages the growing human life from nourishment, and so it dies. So what they would say here in the miscarriage protocol would be that by taking this, it signals to the body that the pregnancy has come to an end. Perhaps the body has not yet heard the news, right? And is still acting as if the pregnancy is viable, even though the nascent human life is now gone or now dead. And so by doing this, it signals it, and that would ease the process here. So in the abortion protocol, it's what actually ends the life of the unborn child. It would be what denies nourishment of the child. In the miscarriage protocol, it would signal to the woman's body something that perhaps hormonally she hasn't been triggered yet in her, an understanding that there is no reason to continue a thicker endometrial wall. There is no life in there, nothing to protect, nothing to nourish. Let's begin the process of ending this pregnancy. And so it serves two different functions, obviously, right? Like in an abortion protocol, it is actually the agent that kills the unborn child. In the miscarriage, they're asking it for to trigger the body and to say, look, it's over. It's time for you to give up and for us to move on. And so it's understanding how that could help, right? And the idea, the science they point to, or at least the one particular article or research that's been done on this, says that process is sped up, it's less painful, and it has a slightly higher success rate of accomplishing the end goal than if you just had misoprostol alone, which is what expels the material.
So just for some of our listeners that might be wanting some clarification, is mifepristone the same thing as the, you know, day after quote-unquote abortion pill, RU486? And then if it is, what percentage of abortions in the United States are currently performed using this drug?
Well, RU486 is mifepristone. That was the popular way of understanding or knowing it. So mifepristone is RU486. What people mean when they say day after pills can vary, right? Some of them are just larger doses of what would normally be oral contraceptives that are meant to stop a woman from ovulating if she's had unprotected sex immediately after. But RU486 is mifepristone. They are the same thing. And the use of that has grown over. And mifepristone first became available in the United States. The FDA cleared it for use in the year 2000, the Clinton administration. That was when what they called this risk evaluation mitigations, the way that we regulate it, came into effect. Because it's, look, we're going to make it legal, but we're going to have hard restrictions on how it's used. We only want certain uses of it, and we want to protect how it's used. And so when they made it legal and put it under that, at that point it was 7 weeks. Under the Obama administration, they expanded the use of mifepristone up to 10 weeks in pregnancy. So doctors can prescribe it up to the 10th week of pregnancy. And since it came in, it has slowly gone up, right? 40% at the last measurement, 40% of all abortions were done through the drug protocol of RU486, mifepristone and misoprostol. 60% of all abortions done in the first 10 weeks are done medically now instead of a surgical abortion. And probably right now the numbers are higher than that after COVID, because there's always a lag when you go to Guttmacher. The ability for them to get information always lags years behind where we actually are today. My guess would be that today those numbers are even higher than the 40% of all abortions and 60% of all abortions that happen in the first 10 weeks. It is becoming quickly the most common way that people seek abortion in the United States.
Is that mainly because of just controversy surrounding going to abortion clinics and just the idea of, you know, it's in your home, and then COVID, you can't go anywhere to clinics, et cetera. So is that why the increase of the use of mifepristone?
Yeah, it's seen, when you read the literature, the people that promote it in that area, it's seen as a more private way. Now, I think we've talked in the past before, especially when we're talking about the Abby Johnson movie Unplanned, which shows a brutal scene of Abby Johnson going through an RU486 abortion, that it is not the easy route that it is sometimes advertised as, or oftentimes advertised, but the idea that rather than surgical, going to a place, because you still have to go. I mean, up until this point, up until COVID, you still had to go to a doctor of Planned Parenthood and get the prescription handed to you by a medical professional. That's what the regulation restrictions that the FDA had. Now, that has largely been relaxed because of COVID. And that's why I say we probably are going to see it even go even more, because it was harder for people to get places and it was harder for people to get to that doctor's office, and they didn't want to gather people in. The FDA said, they didn't lift the restrictions. What they said was, we're going to have discretion in an enforcement of those restrictions. So if you're doing things other than that, we're probably not going to enforce those rules right now. So it hasn't been lifted, but COVID put us into a place where the FDA said, we're going to have discretion in enforcement, so to take your care. And other people have pushed the boundaries a little bit as well. There are some people who have legally looked at the restrictions, regulatory restrictions, and said, I don't think that covers mail order. I think the doctor can prescribe it, and it will still be considered the doctor disseminating the drug directly to the patient if the doctor mails it to the patient. And so you're seeing an increase of people receiving it in the mail too, through telemedicine, where they'll go online, have an online interview with a doctor, and the doctor will then mail them directly mifepristone and misoprostol.
Is there any way in the future to track how many people are using mifepristone? Because in the past, like you said, they would go to a Planned Parenthood clinic. Now, is this like your GP could do it? Is that what they're arguing for, to make it much more readily available so that anyone who's facing miscarriage could go to their family doctor, as opposed to, you know, maybe more narrow type of doctor that could prescribe this pill?
Yeah, they want it treated like anything else. They want pharmacies to be able to fulfill the prescription. They want any doctor to be able to give it to you. Their argument is it's completely safe. Obviously, there's ways to look at that question. They say it's safer than Tylenol, is a claim that they like to make a lot. Safer than Viagra, an readily available drug. They like to point out Viagra also because it points to a disproportionate sense of justice that men can get Viagra, which is ultimately more dangerous than mifepristone is, and they can't get access to it for anything. Now, in this particular case, right, they're arguing about it for miscarriages. And that's the power, I think, of this piece. This article is obviously two women sharing something deeply personal that happened to them. But what they want is freer access to mifepristone for everything, right? Not just for miscarriages, but they just want mifepristone basically set loose from these regulatory restrictions that the FDA puts on them. And their argument for them in this particular article is that women who are facing miscarriage need access to this because it's the best possible care. And when we say they need access, we want it set loose in every possible way that a drug can be set loose so that people can get access to it, because they ought to be able to make that choice for themselves and it ought to be readily available.
You're listening to episode 249 of the Postmodern Realities podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Jay Watts. He has written an online exclusive article for the Christian Research Journal called "Do Abortion Politics Hurt Women Enduring Miscarriage?" And his online exclusive article is available at our website, equip.org, to our subscribers. Now, if you're not a subscriber, you can just pop on over to our website, equip.org, and subscribe for $33.50. But one of the things I want to highlight once again is the contents that we're having, and it goes through the end of this year, December 2021, and we are going to give away a subscription to the Christian Research Journal. It can be a gift subscription, a subscription for yourself or a family member, or maybe even your pastor. And how you enter is really easy. You head on over to Apple Podcasts, and for anybody that enters in with giving us a short written review, their name will be entered into this contest. And when it ends, we will have a drawing for everyone that has posted a comment about this podcast and why they like to listen to it by the end of the year. And it has to be on Apple Podcasts, and it has to be done after July 1st of this year. But so far, we only have one person, so the odds are looking really good for that person, but only if we get up to 100 comments. So we would like to get 100 comments. I don't think it's that hard. I know that you probably are listening and haven't done it yet, so please head on over and do that. The other way you can help us is to tip us for our content, helping us to keep our content free and helping us with our budget. A tip is something small, like $3 or $5, something like that. You can easily do that at our website, equip.org. Go to magazine, to the drop down, Postmodern Realities Podcast, and click on any of the landing pages that you see, and you will find a link where you can give us a tip. And thank you for your partnership.
You were just talking about, you know, the fact that these authors want Mifepristone readily available for more people, and just the power of their story, especially as they tie it to miscarriage more than abortion. I think that causes a lot of empathy for people just to realize, oh, so many women have suffered through miscarriage. It's not talked about. Yes, it was horrible. But I just want to ask you, is it true that if you add the mifepristone in advance of the dose of misoprostol, does it help women medically, you know, get through a miscarriage a lot easier, which is part of their argument, right? Because they could only have this one drug, but if they had both of them, their miscarriages, you know, handling them medically would be much better for all women.
Yeah. And this is where I think it gets interesting, because the objection to mifepristone for miscarriage is not based on the pro-lifers outraged about the idea of mifepristone being used for this. As a matter of fact, in the article, I quote Dr. Christina Francis, who is the board of the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists. And she says, look, I don't object to the use of mifepristone on pro-life principles. I'm just not convinced that it does what they say it does, that it accomplishes what the authors claim. The study that they cite is a New England Journal of Medicine study. And Dr. Francis's concern is that it's a very small study. She said there were 300 total women looked at, split into two groups for control of 150 each. So three people were ultimately taken out. So it's 149 to 148 people total that are actually the two groups that are looked at. And the difference, now when you give it in percentages, it sounds big, right? Like somewhere between 60 to 70% with misoprostol alone are successful. But if you add mifepristone, then you, all of a sudden you go to 80 or 90%. But what ultimately you're talking about in numbers is that in the test, I think 24 women who got both did not get any of the results. Of the 148 women, I think 24 women failed to have the results that they wanted. And when you had just the misoprostol, it was 49 women. And so what she's saying, what Dr. Francis is saying, is that that's not enough. That's not enough to convince me that I need to start doing this as a normal part of my medical treatment. And even when you mentioned at the beginning, you said 26% of pregnancies end in miscarriage, and that's tragic and that's terrible. What's interesting is the site that they use to make that claim, the study that they cite to make the 26% claim, actually in its treatment protocol says that treatment for medical treatment is misoprostol alone. And in that same study that they've cited for the 26, that says most women will achieve complete expulsion within 3 days, and very few need subsequent uterine curettage. So even the studies that they're using are saying these same things. The New England Journal of Medicine article that they point to that makes the case that these women need mifepristone because it makes it more effective, it even says, as part of their reason for doing it, that there's not a field of evidence. There's not a whole lot of studies. There's not anywhere we can point to and say what the actual effectiveness is. And so we need more research. So there is no pro-life objection to using this to help people through miscarriage. The objection comes from medical doctors who say, well, if you want me to start prescribing this particular drug to women in miscarriages, I just need more evidence that it helps. Now, their response is obviously that it doesn't hurt, so might as well give it to them. But if that were just the case of, well, if it's available, we can use it and it doesn't hurt, but we're not sure that it works. But the case they're making is a moral case for changing the regulatory approach to how we deal with mifepristone altogether under this idea that this provides the best possible care. And as Dr. Francis says, if that's true, then I will prescribe mifepristone, but I don't see evidence to convince me that it's necessarily true, that it's helpful. I will do what's best for my patients when I've seen the science demonstrate that. And so I have reason to change the way that I do it. What she says is, right now, all I do is, instead of giving them one dose of the misoprostol when they go home, I give them extra doses so that if it doesn't happen the first time, just take a little bit more and it should take care of it. And she sees no reason to change the entire way of medical treatment of this for what looks like a 15% rise in effectiveness done by one study with a very small sample size.
Now, given her comments, the authors, Alan and Siestra, suggest that this use of mifepristone is actually a preferred method of treating the effects of miscarriage. So if it was more widely available, that would be the number one go-to. And, you know, of course, the doctor you're citing is saying she doesn't see any particular evidence. Do you think it would be more widely used for that, as they're trying to link that this, you know, would be the best way to handle miscarriage, as tragic as that is?
Yeah, it's interesting because it would have been their preferred choice. That's their testimony, right? Their personal testimony is this would have been my preferred choice. And for the one, only one of them, by the way, did misoprostol alone, and she did not have the result that she wanted. What's interesting is that there is no guarantee that she would have had mifepristone as well, because 24 women who got both of those out of 148 still had the same results that she had. But the idea is, because their testimony is that would have been our preferred means of enduring this, then it probably is something necessary for the best possible care. Here's what's interesting. As you see, and I see why they would think that, right? Because in abortion, that is the case. In abortion, more women are opting for that. More women are choosing that. It's growing every year, the number of people that choose that protocol. But when you look at the New England Journal of Medicine article, they said they actually approached 800 women who were medically qualified to participate in this study about being a part of it. They only got 300 that were willing to do it. The 497 that rejected, 303 actually agreed to do it, and then some were disqualified from the project. Of the 497 women that refused, the reason that they most often gave was, I'll just take the surgical option. Because there are, when you're talking about a miscarriage, there are reasons to want it over, right? I mean, there are reasons to, let's take care of this now in the office here today and with a surgical option so that we can move on and not have to go home and wait or endure all the other parts of it. And so it looks like they're, I mean, this is, again, this is a very small sample size, but the idea that this is the best possible care that all of these women want and we're denying them from getting them isn't even supported by the New England Journal of Medicine article that they point to for their data to say that it's a better and more efficient way of accomplishing this goal, because almost 500 of the 800 women that were asked to participate said, no, thank you, we'll take the surgical option. That was the preferred best means by which people would get it. They had a much smaller number of people who were willing to take the medical option in the first place. So I don't think it's evidence. There is not enough evidence, if you, Dr. Francis says, there's not enough evidence that it does what they say it does. And there's not enough evidence that this is not just the best possible, most effective way of treating it, but that it's also the most desired option for people. In both cases, you see evidence otherwise. At least enough evidence so for what they're asking for and using miscarriage as a means to get rid of all regulatory approaches that the FDA has right now towards mifepristone and just to set it loose, there's where you say the evidence isn't there to make that move yet, because it's not necessarily true that we have the science to demonstrate that it works like that. And it's not necessarily true that this is widely sought after and the most desired way of dealing with it. And if it does work and there are women that want to avail themselves of that, then obviously I don't know anybody that has a moral objection to that. It's just to leverage it to get greater access to mifepristone across the board is what's a little bit troubling.
In their article, they write this, quote, "Why weren't we offered the best care? It wasn't an issue of coverage or payment for treatment. Many patients who miscarry are not so fortunate because they have great healthcare," is what their point is. And then they say this, "It wasn't a safety concern. Mifepristone has a 30-year track record of use and can be safer than Tylenol. It wasn't a supply chain issue or unfamiliarity with medicine. It was abortion politics." So in that statement, they say that, you know, this has a 30-year track record of use and can be safer than Tylenol. And so in that, they're making the claim that, you know, this is why, and of course, one of them is an attorney, that these regulations, really, it's overdue for them to be loosened for a drug that has been proven to be quite safe. And so it should be available to them. And yet they were denied this treatment. And we touched on it a little bit earlier. You talked about it. Is that true that it, you know, it's been 30 years, they state. Why not? It's safe as Tylenol. Let's really loosen the regulations.
Yeah, I don't like the, and I mentioned in my response, I really don't like the safer than Tylenol approach to arguing about it. I feel like it undermines their point. It's a cute thing to say, But if you go to the source for that information, what you'll find out is that the reason they're saying it's safer than Tylenol is that the number of women who have died directly as a, that we can target and say these women died from mifepristone, there was complications from that, are very low. I mean, I think the source where they're quoting actually has that number. It's somewhere like 13 women have died from the, there's been more that have died from other complications where you have secondary issues. But when you're talking about people who died directly from mifepristone, it's a very, very low number. And then they point to Tylenol as the number one cause of liver failure in the United States because people OD on acetaminophen. I think that's an unfair comparison, right? In one particular case, you're talking about a very heavily regulated drug with extreme regulations on it placed by the Food and Drug Administration that prevent people from being able to misuse it, which is exactly the point of those regulations. And then the other, you have one of the most easily available drugs that you can purchase over the counter, and people who make terrible decisions and misuse it and abuse it and don't do what you're supposed to do with it, and then ultimately have liver failure. That's really apples and oranges. And so the comparison, I think, is not only not helpful, but it undermines the credibility and the claims that they're making. Also, what you find when you look into the research on people who make the claim of the safety of this particular drug and abortion in general versus other things, is you start to find that they talk about it in only terms of mortality, but not morbidity. And so things can get a little harder to track when you start to talk about other issues, other health issues in addition to death, right? We track death, but we don't track every health issue additional to what might have happened. And so it's not necessarily clear when all you're dealing with are mortality rates, people that died from the use of mifepristone. It's not true or not clear that it's safe because we don't look at morbidity rates and what kind of secondary issues may be caused by the use of it or the people that have to dealt with or have dealt with in the past as a result of those things. And so I'm not a fan of how they trumpet the safety in that sense, beyond the fact that as every person who has ever dealt with this on the abortion side would point out immediately, safe for whom, right? I mean, obviously, the idea would be that any drug that you would give, particularly if we're giving it for the case of miscarriage, where there is no life being taken, but where the life inside the mother has already died, we hope that it's safe for her in that sense. When we expand it beyond miscarriage, every single abortion is 100% fatal to the unborn life inside the woman. It's the very reason, obviously, for the abortion in the first place. And mifepristone is used primarily for that purpose, to destroy a nascent human life, to end its life before you expel it through the use of misoprostol.
Well, their subtitle is that this particular, you know, constituation of miscarriage, you know, abortion politics make them worse. And they write this, quote, mifepristone is restricted in the United States for political reasons. Pharmacies are prohibited from stocking it. This means that because of opposition to abortion, mifepristone is as heavily regulated as drugs like OxyContin. Anti-abortion policies frequently ensnare miscarriages and funnel women who lose wanted pregnancies into substandard treatments that can lengthen their pain and suffering. So that sounds pretty horrific from their point of view. And so one thing that you mention in your article is that you say that politics are being played on both sides of the issue. And so what other politics are part of the mix? They're saying it's, you know, pro-life politics that's causing this restriction of a needed drug.
Yeah, the idea of politics, the politics, and I mentioned the article, politics flow in both directions, right? So let's ask ourselves a question. I just mentioned earlier that I don't know any pro-lifers that are in any way against the idea of this being used specifically in the case to make life easier on a woman who is facing a miscarriage, even quoting a pro-life physician and Dr. Francis, who says, oh, yeah, as soon as I trust that the science is good here, I'd be happy if it helps women to do this. So why is it that they write this article and we don't, pro-lifers like myself or the people that represent the view that I represent in the public square, we don't immediately rush to their side and say, yes, by all means, let's make it easier to get mifepristone? Because there's a lack of trust, because I say the politics are running in both directions, right? This particular article is asking for easier access to that particular drug for what we consider to be a noble reason. But that's not the broader movement or the broader incentive to make access to that drug easier. We know this because you can go read any number of different publications, but not just from the ACLU, from NARAL, from Ms. Magazine, from Planned Parenthood and Guttmacher. Go read all of them. Every single one of them at this point are fighting to lift these regulatory restrictions that the FDA has placed on it for the point of having what they call telemedicine abortions, so that you, I mentioned earlier, you can Zoom in with a doctor, they can prescribe to you this drug, they can mail it to you, that you can get it from your pharmacy. They want open access, easy access to it. And the overwhelming majority of time they're talking about this, as a matter of fact, almost every time I've ever heard them fighting for this, it was not for miscarriage. It is almost always about abortion. And so they, obviously, any reasonable person would understand why there is distrust at this moment, where they say, well, look, this is a terrible story. And because of this, we were denied the best possible care, and we had to endure things we shouldn't have had to endure. And if you just made this more available to us, we would never have had to go through that. Which is, that's great. We don't want anybody to ever have to go through those things. We understand it's a terrible tragedy. It's an awful thing that every human being that has to endure it should be given the best possible means to get through it. But just 2 seconds ago, you were over there arguing about this for abortion, not miscarriage. So you need to understand why I'm a little bit hesitant to jump on your side and to try to open the gate so that you can get more access to it. Because you might be using this particular tragedy as a political tool to open up doors to other things that you want done for different reasons and in areas where we have an entirely different moral approach to this issue. And so that's what I say, the politics are being done on both sides. For anybody to say, oh, well, look, politics are keeping women from getting proper care, we've already looked at the idea of maybe it's not the best possible care. Maybe that's an overstatement of it. Or if it is the best possible care, we're not really at the point where we've been able to demonstrate that. And maybe there isn't just this clamoring of women everywhere to be able to get access to this drug for this reason. But I know 100% for certain that most of the time that you're talking about releasing the regulations that are placed on this particular drug, you're talking about it so that women have better and easier access to private abortions that are more difficult to track and that are easier for people to facilitate. And so there is where I say the politics run in both directions, and that politics, to put it and to frame it in the place that the pro-lifers have done something horrible by seeking regulation of this drug different than other drugs, and it should be, in my mind, regulated differently than other drugs. It's a drug whose entire reason for existing when it came into the United States was largely and most primarily to end human life. It makes sense that if that's what you're going to use that drug for most of the time, that we have a harder look at it and we take measures to make sure that the people who are using it in the most responsible way possible when we're talking about what we're talking about, which is already a horrible thing in and of itself. To act like it's all from one side that the politics are being played, to me, is ultimately dishonest. It's misleading. The reason that we'd be suspicious of you is not because we don't want to help people going through miscarriages, is but because we're suspicious that on one hand, we have these strident supporters of abortion rights who are fighting for greater access to abortion across the board, where no regulation, no interference is allowed. And then on the other hand, we have people sharing a deeply painful personal story and testimony about something they had to endure. That side, I'm completely empathetic with, and I want to help you out as much as you can. But the problem is, it's difficult for me to trust that that's all you want out of this when everybody else on your side is talking about this for abortion.
Earlier in the podcast, we talked about the COVID of 2020 and, you know, how that impacted the FDA's treatment of mifepristone. So under the current Biden administration, are they likely to return to, you know, pre-COVID ways of thinking about how mifepristone should be dispensed?
Yeah, and here's where you get the pressure from the people who are most responsible for getting Biden, like the support that Biden gets. For example, I quote Cynthia Pearson of the National Women's Health Network when she said, anything less than permanently lifting all of the restrictions will be a capitulation to anti-abortion pressure. So imagine a very powerful lobbying body, which President Biden and his administration are already ideologically on the side of, looking at them now and saying, it's great that you are giving discretion now to the prosecution of these cases, that you're not enforcing it, that you're letting people do things. It's all still in the books, but you're not enforcing those laws. Now it's time to lift those regulations all together and to get rid of them. And when that powerful lobbying group looks at somebody who's already on their side on this issue and says, anything short of lifting them all together will be seen as you expressing anti-abortion position and working for the other side against us, it's really difficult to imagine that they're not going to be sensitive to that pressure, right? There's no reason for them to not take the next step outside of a sense of pressure from the community. And that's, again, where we get the politics flowing in both directions. If there was hesitancy, because there are still enough people who are hesitant about abortion, as much as the people who feel the most strongly about it on either way are polar opposites as far as how they talk about things, the people in the middle, when you look at the polling, still tend to be a little uncomfortable with it. They don't want to interfere with other people, but they also don't want them to have free and easy access to everything the way that it's sought by the people who are abortion rights advocates. And so will Biden be a voice of reason and say, well, let's keep that? Well, he's not being that voice anywhere else, right? He gets rid of the Mexico City policy. He's trying to get rid of the Hyde Amendment. Everything that he's doing right now is moving towards freer and open access and government funding of abortion. So why on earth would we think that he wouldn't put this in his crosshairs and get rid of it as well? You've given a little bit to a group of people that now want more. And that group of people is on his side. They're powerful lobbyists, and they can help him get political power in other areas going down the line. So I think that it would be foolish to believe that the Biden administration won't see this as an opportunity to say, well, we've already taken this step, so why don't we just keep moving forward and loosen up the restrictions on mifepristone altogether? Let's make it something much easier for people to get to. Let's lose the regulation. So we're going to lose sight of how many abortions are happening, because it's going to be much easier for people to do it without people knowing where that drug is going and who's disseminating it.
Allen and Siestra end their opinion piece by writing this, quote, "The mifepristone regulations benefit no one, regardless of whether a person is choosing to end a pregnancy or miscarrying. It's time for the FDA to allow patients to access this drug without red tape designed to stigmatize abortion." So is that true regarding these regulations on mifepristone?
Do they benefit no one? See, that's hard for me, because in one sense, we've already said that the percentage of abortions being performed medically is rising. So it'd be hard for me to make a pro-life case that these regulations are working. But we also see the number of abortions going down. We see the number of doctors that want to be involved in doing abortions going down. We see some hopeful things. Now, we don't know. I've heard a lot of people say we're probably going to see a bump back up because of COVID and things are going to change. Once this data comes in, we're going to see a change. But over the years, the trend has been the population increases, the incidence of abortion decrease, which means it's not just the number of abortions are decreasing. They're decreasing also as the population increases, which means that far fewer people are starting to get abortions than once did. And so you're seeing a trend in the right direction. So I don't know. I would look at it and say, well, they've worked. I don't know that they've worked or not. But I do know this. If by no one, you are completely ignoring the idea of the unborn life that is lost through abortion when you say that the mifepristone regulations benefit no one, there's a chance that it benefits the unborn by making it more difficult to get access to it. There's a chance that more human lives were allowed to continue to live because you didn't make it easier to destroy them. I can't think of a single time in history where we made it as easy as we possibly could to destroy life, and yet people chose to save life or to endure or to preserve life more. Where the more society says it's nothing, just keep doing it at will, it doesn't seem like that's a healthy thing for unborn human life. And since at the end of the day, when we talk about what mifepristone exists to do, it exists primarily to destroy that life, the earliest stages of development, I can't help but think that having steps within the system that say our country, our government, the regulatory bodies all acknowledge that this is a different thing and it ought to be treated seriously and differently, even though they're not restricting it and restricting access to it in the sense of saying you can't have it, at least they recognize the seriousness of what's going on, or at least pay homage to the fact that a great number of Americans see this as something terrible. And so they say, let's restrict access. Let's take this very seriously. Let's see where this drug is going so that we clearly understand who's using it and how and where it's going and the numbers that are being done. So I can't see how it would benefit the unborn if you suddenly say, wide open, like Wild West, no laws, just give it to whoever wants to get it as best we can through all of these different means, and you lose track of it. It seems like when you say it benefits no one, all you're doing is making the first basic mistake that people make oftentimes when they talk about abortion. They assume that the unborn are no one. And that the idea that these restrictions or regulations may in some way or another protect some of that life. We don't know that that's the case, but it may protect some of that life. It may put just that one extra burden on the entire system so that someone has a moment to think and consider and will choose that life, that child, to let it be born. By the way, I have worked with pregnancy centers for years. I have seen women repeatedly bring their babies back and say, I almost made a mistake, but I kept this life. It's the greatest thing that ever happened to me. This child is the center of my world. It has focused me. It has helped me to make better decisions, not just for her, but for me. I see those stories all the time. It's very rare. I've never, as a matter of fact, for me, I've never heard of one time of anybody bringing a child back and saying, you idiots made me keep this child and now I'm painfully unhappy and I hate everything about it. Most of the people that are making this decision when they come back or we contact them and talk to them, they're thrilled with the decision that they made to preserve life. So if those regulations make it so maybe one more person will choose life, then it benefited someone. And the unborn aren't no one. And that's what the problem is, that the only way to accept their argument without any pushback at all is if I accept the premise of their argument, which is that the unborn are not due any consideration in this issue at all. All that's necessary for us to consider is whether giving this drug to any particular woman is healthy in some sense for the woman. Now, again, I agree with them on the miscarriage thing. I want to help women that are enduring or facing miscarriages, but I don't trust their motivation for wanting to open the regulatory doors on mifepristone. And at the end of the day, when they say, well, it benefits no one, I'm like, well, see, that's why we don't trust each other. Because it may benefit someone. It may benefit the one life that you'd have just completely discounted in this whole equation here. And that's the unborn life that will certainly be killed more often than not when the primary purpose of the mifepristone is used correctly.
Well, finally, on a very much lighter note than our conversation, I have some fun rapid fire questions for Jay. So Jay, what's a new place you visited recently? If in fact you have, because, you know, we're just coming out of COVID and people are starting to travel again.
Yeah, well, I got a double and overlap. My daughter is in a very competitive lacrosse team, my 12-year-old daughter, and I was speaking in the D.C. area. And so we went to her competition was in Boyds, Maryland, but we were in Gaithersburg, Maryland. And I only missed this because I stayed at a lot of hotels, either for work or for my daughter's lacrosse. And there was this area in Gaithersburg that was this commercial area. And I can't remember the name of it, but it was wonderful. Gaithersburg, Maryland was wonderful. I had such a great time there. It was the best tournament I've ever been to as far as the facility, but also the place where we stayed. You just had this hotel and restaurants and movie theaters and one of those multi-use facility areas where people lived as well. That was just beautiful and lovely and fun. And so Gaithersburg, Maryland is a place that I got to visit recently that I walked away from just really impressed and happy to be there.
Fill in this blank. I've had enough of.
I've had enough of television. Just, you know, I don't like television that much and being on vacation with my family, which I've been on for the last week. Part of vacation for them is that daddy can't be as restrictive for them as watching television. And man, they have just been binge watching shows on Netflix when they're not at the beach. And I am so sick of television. So I've had enough of television right now.
And besides your family, what is the best part of your life right now?
I mentioned lacrosse a lot when we talk. And it came, there's something that came to an end. For the last year, when COVID started and the restrictions for being able to move around started, as soon as they opened up the parks, my son and my daughters and I would go work out together in the morning. And then what happened was a lot of other families found out we were going up there and asked, could their kids, players, come up and work out with us as well? And for a year, more than a year, we had like 20 kids, a lot of times like 20-something middle school girls who were getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning, every morning that they could. And they would come and meet us up there at like 7 o'clock in the morning, work out for 2 hours. And it was a special thing for a lot of people. Even I remember talking to people, families, their parents would come and would walk around the field and they would talk to each other. And in the midst of it was a very dark time over the last year. And a lot of times where our ability to meet and be around other people was restricted. Interestingly enough, lacrosse, you know, I don't know how much, you know, your listeners may know or not know, but lacrosse was originally a Native American sport. The indigenous tribes of the United States were the founders of lacrosse. They called it the medicine game. What they mean is that everything's better when you're playing lacrosse. You know, play lacrosse to mourn, play lacrosse to celebrate, play lacrosse to get exercise. The medicine game makes everything better. And we talked about that a lot when we were all up there. I mean, it was you would just this community playing together, working out together, exercising. It may seem silly to hear, but it was just it was a powerful thing for a year there. And it's just now coming to an end because all of the kids are going back to school in earnest, and it's going back to a more normal life down here. But it was beautiful. It was a lovely thing to be involved with that and to coach a bunch of kids from high schoolers, but largely the biggest group of them were like 12 to 13-year-old girls, serious athletes, passionate about what they were doing, but just loving being together. It was beautiful. So that, I'm happy about that. Lacrosse, I love it. It's the medicine game.
Well, thanks, Jay, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you. It was great to be.
You've been listening to episode 249 of the Postmodern Realities podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Jay Watts, who has written an online exclusive article for the Christian Research Journal. The title of his article is "Do Abortion Politics Hurt Women Enduring Miscarriage?" And it's a response to a recent New York Times opinion piece about this subject. Our subscribers can access it free online when they log into their accounts at our website, equip.org. We'd like to connect to you, so please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man YouTube channel and join in the conversation in the comments section and in the live chat when we have premiere videos. Please follow the Bible Answer Man page on Facebook and on Twitter. You will find us at Hank Hanegraaff, Bible Answer Man, Christian Research Institute, and Christian Research Journal, as well as on Instagram at the Bible Answer Man account. You won't want to miss every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern when we live stream the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff at our website, equip.org. In addition, please subscribe to the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank gets out of the studio and into his study and engages in in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. You'll want to head on over to equip.org because there you're going to find thousands of free resources for you in articles and past broadcasts, our podcasts, and videos. And thank you for all the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute.